and here as well the plague confessed defeat. A little before dawn, Rieu leaned toward his mother and whispered, "You'd better have some rest now, as you'll have to relieve me at 8. Mind you, take your drops before going to bed." Madame Rieu rose, folded her knitting, and went to the bedside. Tarou had had his eyes shut for some time. Sweat had plastered his hair on his stubborn forehead. Madame Rieu sighed, and he opened his eyes. He saw the gentle face bent over him, and, athwart the surge of fever, that steadfast smile took form again. But at once the eyes closed. Left to himself, Rieu moved into the chair his mother had just left. The street was silent, and no sound came from the sleeping town. The chill of daybreak was beginning to make itself felt. The doctor dozed off, but very soon an early cart rattling down the street awaked him. Shivering a little, he looked at Tarou and saw that a lull had come. He, too, was sleeping. The iron-shod wheels rumbled away into the distance. Darkness still was pressing on the window panes. When the doctor came beside the bed, Tarou gazed at him with expressionless eyes, like a man still on the frontier of sleep.
"You slept, didn't you?" Rieu asked.
"Yes." "Breathing better?"
"A bit."
"Does that mean anything?" Rieu kept silent for some moments, then he said, "No, Tarou, it doesn't mean anything. You know as well as I that there's often a remission in the morning."
"Thanks."
Tarou nodded his approval.
"Always tell me the exact truth."
Rieu was sitting on the side of the bed. Beside him, he could feel the sick man's legs, stiff and hard as the limbs of an effigy on a tomb. Tarou was breathing with more difficulty.
"The fever'll come back, won't it, Rieu?" he gasped.
"Yes, but at noon we shall know where we stand." Tarou shut his eyes. He seemed to be mustering up his strength. There was a look of utter weariness on his face. He was waiting for the fever to rise, and already it was stirring somewhat in the depths of his being. When he opened his eyes, his gaze was misted. It brightened only when he saw Rieu bending over him, a tumbler in his hand.
"Drink."
Tarou drank, then slowly lowered his head onto the pillow.
"It's a long business," he murmured.
Rieu clasped his arm, but Tarou, whose head was averted, showed no reaction. Then suddenly, as if some inner dike had given way without warning, the fever surged back, dyeing his cheeks and forehead. Tarou's eyes came back to the doctor, who, bending again, gave him a look of affectionate encouragement. Tarou tried to shape a smile, but it couldn't force its way through the set jaws and lips welded by dry saliva. In the rigid face, only the eyes lived still, glowing with courage. At 7, Madame Rieu returned to the bedroom. The doctor went to the surgery to ring up the hospital and arrange for a substitute. He also decided to postpone his consultations, then lay down for some moments on the surgery couch. 5 minutes later, he went back to the bedroom. Tarou's face was turned toward Madame Rieu, who was sitting close beside the bed, her hands folded on her lap. In the dim light of the room, she seemed no more than a darker patch of shadow. Tarou was gazing at her so intently that, putting a finger to her lips, Madame Rieu rose and switched off the bedside lamp. Behind the curtains, the light was growing, and presently, when the sick man's face grew visible, Madame Rieu could see his eyes still intent on her. Bending above the bed, she smoothed out the bolster and, as she straightened up, laid her hand for a moment on his moist, tangled hair. Then she heard a muffled voice, which seemed to come from very far away, murmur, "Thank you." And that all was well now. By the time she was back in her chair, Theroux had shut his eyes, and, despite the sealed mouth, a faint smile seemed to hover on the wasted face. At noon, the fever reached its climax. A visceral cough racked the sick man's body, and he now was spitting blood. The ganglia had ceased swelling, but they were still there, like lumps of iron embedded in the joints. Rieu decided that lancing them was impracticable. Now and then, in the intervals between bouts of fever and coughing fits, Theroux still gazed at his friends. But soon his eyes opened less and less often, and the glow that shone out from the ravaged face in the brief moments of recognition grew steadily fainter. The storm, lashing his body into convulsive movement, lit it up with ever rarer flashes. And in the heart of the tempest, he was slowly drifting, derelict. And now Rieu had before him only a mask-like face, inert, from which the smile had gone forever. This human form, his friend's, lacerated by the spear thrusts of the plague, consumed by searing, superhuman fires, buffeted by all the raging winds of heaven, was foundering under his eyes in the dark flood of the pestilence, and he could do nothing to avert the wreck. He could only stand, unavailing, on the shore, empty-handed and sick at heart, unarmed and helpless yet again under the onset of calamity. And thus, when the end came, the tears that blinded Rieu's eyes were tears of impotence. And he didn't see Theroux roll over, face to the wall, and die with a short, hollow groan, as if somewhere within him an essential cord had snapped. The next night was not one of struggle, but of silence. In the tranquil death chamber, beside the dead body, now in everyday clothing, here too Rieu felt it brooding, that elemental peace which, when he was sitting many nights before on the terrace high above the plague, had followed the brief foray at the gates. Then already it had brought to his mind the silence brooding over the beds in which he had let men die. There, as here, it was the same solemn pause, the lull that follows battle. It was the silence of defeat. But the silence now enveloping his dead friend, so dense, so much akin to the nocturnal silence of the streets and of the town set free at last, made Rieu cruelly aware that this defeat was final. The last disastrous battle that ends a war and makes peace itself an ill beyond all remedy. The doctor couldn't tell if Theroux had found peace, now that all was over. But for himself he had a feeling that no peace was possible to him henceforth, any more than there can be an armistice for a mother bereaved of her son, or for a man who buries his friend. The night was cold again, with frosty stars sparkling in a clear wintry sky. And in the dimly lit room they felt the cold pressing itself to the window panes and heard the long, silvery suspiration of a polar night. Madame Rieu sat near the bed in her usual attitude, her right side lit up by the bedside lamp. In the center of the room, outside the little zone of light, Ryu sat, waiting. Now and then thoughts of his wife waylaid him, but he brushed them aside each time. When the night began, the heels of passers-by had rung briskly in the frozen air. "Have you attended to everything?" Madame Ryu had asked. "Yes, I've telephoned." Then they had resumed their silent vigil. From time to time, Madame Ryu stole a glance at her son. And whenever he caught her doing this, he smiled. Out in the street, the usual nighttime sounds bridged the long silences. A good many cars were on the road again, though officially this wasn't permitted. They sped past with a long hiss of tires on the pavement, receded, and returned. Voices, distant calls, silence again, a clatter of horse hooves, the squeal of streetcars rounding a curve, vague murmurs, then once more the quiet breathing of the night.
"Bernard?"
"Yes."
"Not too tired?"
"No." At that moment, he knew what his mother was thinking, and that she loved him. But he knew, too, that to love someone means relatively little, or rather that love is never strong enough to find the words befitting it. Thus, he and his mother would always love each other silently. And one day she, or he, would die, without ever, all their lives long, having gone farther than this by way of making their affection known. Thus, too, he had lived at Taru's side. And Taru had died this evening without their friendships having had time to enter fully into the life of either. Taru had lost the match, as he put it. But what had he, Ryu, won? No more than the experience of having known plague and remembering it, of having known friendship and remembering it, of knowing affection and being destined one day to remember it. So all a man could win in the conflict between plague and life was knowledge and memories. But Taru, perhaps, would have called that winning the match. Another car passed, and Madame Ryu stirred slightly. Ryu smiled toward her. She assured him she wasn't tired and immediately added, "You must go and have a good long rest in the mountains. Over there." "Yes, Mother." Certainly he'd take a rest. Over there. It too would be a pretext for memory. But if that was what it meant, winning the match, how hard it must be to live only with what one knows and what one remembers, cut off from what one hopes for. It was thus, most probably, that Taru had lived, and he realized the bleak sterility of a life without illusions. There can be no peace without hope. And Taru, denying as he did the right to condemn anyone whomsoever, though he knew well that no one can help condemning, and it befalls even the victim sometimes to turn executioner, Taru had lived a life riddled with contradictions and had never known hope's solace. Did that explain his aspiration toward saintliness, his quest of peace by service in the cause of others? Actually, Ryu had no idea of the answer to that question, and it mattered little. The only picture of Taru he would always have would be the picture of a man who firmly gripped the steering wheel of his car when driving, or else the picture of that stalwart body now lying motionless. Knowing meant that. A living warmth and a picture of death.
That, no doubt, explains Dr. Rieu's composure on receiving next morning the news of his wife's death. He was in the surgery. His mother came in, almost running, and handed him a telegram. Then went back to the hall to give the telegraph boy a tip. When she returned, her son was holding the telegram open in his hand. She looked at him, but his eyes were resolutely fixed on the window. It was flooded with the effulgence of the morning sun rising above the harbor. "Bernard," she said gently. The doctor turned and looked at her almost as if she were a stranger. "The telegram?" "Yes," he said. "That's it. A week ago." Madame Rieu turned her face toward the window. Rieu kept silent for a while. Then he told his mother not to cry. He'd been expecting it. But it was hard all the same. And he knew in saying this that this suffering was nothing new. For many months, and for the last 2 days, it was the self-same suffering, going on and on. At last, at daybreak on a fine February morning, the ceremonial opening of the gates took place, acclaimed by the populace, the newspapers, the radio, and official communiques. It only remains for the narrator to give what account he can of the rejoicings that followed, though he himself was one of those debarred from sharing in them wholeheartedly. Elaborate day and night fêtes were organized, and at the same time smoke began to rise from locomotives in the station, and ships were already heading for our harbor, reminders in their diverse ways that this was the long-awaited day of reuniting and the end of tears for all who had been parted. We can easily picture, at this stage, the consequences of that feeling of separation, which had so long rankled in the hearts of so many of our townsfolk. Trains coming in were as crowded as those that left the town in the course of the day. Every passenger had reserved his seat long in advance, and had been on tenterhooks during the past fortnight, lest, at the last moment, the authorities should go back on their decision. Some of these incoming travelers were still somewhat nervous, though as a rule they knew the lot of those nearest and dearest to them. They were still in the dark about others and the town itself, of which their imagination painted a grim and terrifying picture. But this applies only to people who hadn't been eating their hearts out during the long months of exile, and not to parted lovers. The lovers, indeed, were wholly wrapped up in their fixed idea, and for them one thing only had changed. Whereas during those months of separation time had never gone quickly enough for their liking, and they were always wanting to speed his flight, now that they were in sight of the town, they would have liked to slow it down and hold each moment in suspense. Once the brakes went on and the train was entering the station, for the sensation, confused perhaps, but nonetheless poignant for that, of all those days and weeks and months of life lost to their love made them vaguely feel they were entitled to some compensation. This present hour of joy should run at half the speed of those long hours of waiting. And the people who awaited them at home or on the platform, among the latter, Rambert, whose wife, warned in good time, had got busy at once and was coming by the first train, were likewise fretting with impatience and quivering with anxiety, for even Rambert felt a nervous tremor at the thought that soon he would have to confront a love and a devotion that the plague months had slowly refined to a pale abstraction, with the flesh-and-blood woman who had given rise to them. If only he could put the clock back and be once more the man who, at the outbreak of the epidemic, had had only one thought and one desire. To escape and return to the woman he loved. But that, he knew, was out of the question now. He had changed too greatly. The plague had forced on him a detachment which, try as he might, he couldn't think away, and which, like a formless fear, haunted his mind. Almost, he thought, the plague had ended too abruptly. He hadn't had time to pull himself together. Happiness was bearing down on him full speed, the event outrunning expectation. Rambert understood that all would be restored to him in a flash, and joy break on him like a flame with which there is no dallying. Everyone, indeed, more or less consciously, felt as he did, and it's of all those people on the platform that we wish to speak. Each was returning to his personal life, yet the sense of comradeship persisted, and they were exchanging smiles and cheerful glances among themselves. But the moment they saw the smoke of the approaching engine, the feeling of exile vanished before an uprush of overpowering, bewildering joy. And when the train stopped, all those interminable seeming separations, which often had begun on this same platform, came to an end in one ecstatic moment, when arms closed with hungry possessiveness on bodies whose living shape they had forgotten. As for Rambert, he hadn't time to see that form running toward him. Already she had flung herself upon his breast, and with his arms locked around her, pressing to his shoulder the head of which he saw only the familiar hair, he let his tears flow freely, unknowing if they rose from present joy or from sorrow too long repressed, aware only that they would prevent his making sure if the face buried in the hollow of his shoulder was the face of which he had dreamed so often or, instead, a stranger's face. For the moment, he wished to behave like all those others around him who believed, or made believe, that plague can come and go without changing anything in men's hearts. Nestling to one another, they went to their homes, blind to the outside world, and seemingly triumphant over the plague, forgetting every sadness in the plight of those who had come by the same train and found no one awaiting them, and were bracing themselves to hear in their homes a confirmation of the fear that the long silence had already implanted in their hearts. For these last, who had now for company only their newborn grief, for those who at this moment were dedicating themselves to a lifelong memory of bereavement, for these unhappy people, matters were very different. The pangs of separation had touched their climax. For the mothers, husbands, wives, and lovers who had lost all joy, now that the loved one lay under a layer of quicklime in a death pit, or was a mere handful of indistinctive ashes in a gray mound, the plague had not yet ended. But who gave a thought to these lonely mourners? Routing the cold flaws that had been threshing the air since early morning, the sun was pouring on the town a steady flood of tranquil light. In the forts on the hills, under the sky of pure, unwavering blue, guns were thundering without a break. And everyone was out and about to celebrate those crowded moments when the time of ordeal ended and the time of forgetting hadn't yet begun. In streets and squares, people were dancing. Within 24 hours, the motor traffic had doubled, and the ever more numerous cars were held up at every turn by merry-making crowds. Every church bell was in full peal throughout the afternoon, and the bells filled the blue and gold sky with their reverberations. Indeed, in all the churches, Thanksgiving services were being held. But at the same time, the places of entertainment were packed, and the cafes, caring nothing for the morrow, were producing their last bottles of liquor. A noisy concourse surged round every bar, including loving couples who fondled each other without a thought for appearances. All were laughing or shouting. The reserves of emotion pent up during those many months when for everybody the flame of life burned low were being recklessly squandered to celebrate this, the red-letter day of their survival. Tomorrow, real life would begin again, with its restrictions. But for the moment, people in very different walks of life were rubbing shoulders, fraternizing. The leveling out that death's imminence had failed in practice to accomplish was realized at last, for a few gay hours, in the rapture of escape. But this rather tawdry exuberance was only one aspect of the town that day. Not a few of those filling the streets at sundown, among them Rombert and his wife, hid under an air of calm satisfaction subtler forms of happiness. Many couples indeed, and many families, looked like people out for a casual stroll, no more than that. In reality, most of them were making sentimental pilgrimages to places where they had gone to school with suffering. The newcomers were being shown the striking or obscure tokens of the plague, relics of its passage. In some cases, the survivor merely played the part of guide, the eyewitness who has been through it, and talked freely of the danger without mentioning his fear. These were the milder forms of pleasure, little more than recreation. In other cases, however, there was more emotion to these walks about the town, as when a man, pointing to some place charged for him with sad yet tender associations, would say to the girl or woman beside him, "This is where, one evening just like this, I longed for you so desperately, and you weren't there." These passionate pilgrims could readily be distinguished. They formed oases of whispers, aloof, self-centered, in the turbulence of the crowd. Far more effectively than the bands playing in the squares, they vouched for the vast joy of liberation. These ecstatic couples, locked together, hardly speaking, proclaimed in the midst of the tumult of rejoicing, with the proud egoism and injustice of happy people, that the plague was over, the reign of terror ended. Calmly they denied, in the teeth of the evidence, that we had ever known a crazy world in which men were killed off like flies, or that precise savagery, that calculated frenzy of the plague, which instilled an odious freedom as to all that was not the here and now, or those charnel house stenches which stupefied whom they didn't kill. In short, they denied that we had ever been that hag-ridden populace, a part of which was daily fed into a furnace and went up in oily fumes, while the rest, in shackled impotence, waited their turn. That, anyhow, was what seemed evident to Rieu when, towards the close of the afternoon, on his way to the outskirts of the town, he walked alone in an uproar of bells, guns, bands, and deafening shouts. There was no question of his taking a day off. Sick men have no holidays. Through the cool, clear light bathing the town rose the familiar smells of roasting meat and anise-flavored liquor. All around him, happy faces were turned toward the shining sky. Men and women with flushed cheeks embraced one another with low, tense cries of desire. Yes, the plague had ended with the terror, and those passionately straining arms told what it had meant. Exile and deprivation in the profoundest meaning of the words. For the first time, Rieu found that he could give a name to the family likeness that for several months he had detected in the faces in the streets. He had only to look around him now. At the end of the plague, with its misery and privations, these men and women had come to wear the aspect of the part they had been playing for so long, the part of emigrants, whose faces first and now their clothes told of long banishment from a distant homeland. Once plague had shut the gates of the town, they had settled down to a life of separation, barred from the living warmth that gives forgetfulness of all. In different degrees, in every part of the town, men and women had been yearning for a reunion, not of the same kind for all, but for all alike ruled out. Most of them had longed intensely for an absent one, for the warmth of a body, for love, or merely for a life that habit had endeared. Some often, without knowing it, suffered from being deprived of the company of friends and from their inability to get in touch with them through the usual channels of friendship. Letters, trains, and boats. Others, fewer these, Taru may have been one of them, had desired reunion with something they couldn't have defined, but which seemed to them the only desirable thing on earth. For want of a better name, they sometimes called it peace. Ryu walked on. As he progressed, the crowds grew thicker, the din multiplied, and he had a feeling that his destination was receding as he advanced. Gradually he found himself drawn into the seething, clamorous mass and understanding more and more the cry that went up from it, a cry that, for some part at least, was his. Yes, they had suffered together, in body no less than in soul, from a cruel leisure, exile without redress, thirst that was never slaked. Among the heaps of corpses, the clanging bells of ambulances, the warnings of what goes by the name of fate, among unremitting waves of fear and agonized revolt, the horror that such things could be. Always a great voice had been ringing in the ears of these forlorn, panicked people, a voice calling them back to the land of their desire, a homeland. It lay outside the walls of the stifled, strangled town, in the fragrant brushwood of the hills, in the waves of the sea, under free skies, and in the custody of love. And it was to this, their lost home, toward happiness, they longed to return, turning their backs disgustedly on all else. As to what that exile and that longing for reunion meant, Ryu had no idea. But as he walked ahead, jostled on all sides, accosted now and then, and gradually made his way into less crowded streets, he was thinking it has no importance whether such things have or have not a meaning. All we need consider is the answer given to men's hope. Henceforth he knew the answer, and he perceived it better now he was in the outskirts of the town, in almost empty streets. Those who, clinging to their little own, had set their hearts solely on returning to the home of their love, had sometimes their reward, though some of them were still walking the streets alone, without the one they had awaited. Then again, those were happy who hadn't suffered a twofold separation, like some of us who, in the days before the epidemic, had failed to build their love on a solid basis at the outset, and had spent years blindly groping for the pact, so slow and hard to come by, that in the long run binds together ill-assorted lovers. Such people had had, like Ryu himself, the rashness of counting overmuch on time, and now they were parted forever. But others, like Rombert, to whom the doctor had said early that morning, "Courage, it's up to you now to prove you're right," had, without faltering, welcomed back the loved one who they thought was lost to them. and for some time, anyhow, they would be happy. They knew now that if there's one thing one can always yearn for and sometimes attain, it is human love. But for those others who aspired beyond and above the human individual towards something they couldn't even imagine, there had been no answer. Tarrou might seem to have won through to that hardly come-by peace of which he used to speak, but he had found it only in death, too late to turn it to account. If others, however, Ryu could see them in the doorways of houses, passionately embracing and gazing hungrily at one another in the failing sunset glow, had got what they wanted, this was because they had asked for the one thing that depended on them solely. And as he turned the corner of the street where Grand and Kotar lived, Ryu was thinking it was only right that those whose desires are limited to man in this humble yet formidable love should enter, if only now and then, into their reward. This chronicle is drawing to an end, and this seems to be the moment for Dr. Bernard Rieu to confess that he is the narrator. But before describing the closing scenes, he would wish anyhow to justify his undertaking and to set it down that he expressly made a point of adopting the tone of an impartial observer. His profession put him in touch with a great many of our townspeople while plague was raging, and he had opportunities of hearing their various opinions. Thus he was well placed for giving a true account of all he saw and heard. But in so doing, he has tried to keep within the limits that seemed desirable. For instance, in a general way, he has confined himself to describing only such things as he was enabled to see for himself, and has refrained from attributing to his fellow sufferers thoughts that, when all is said and done, they weren't bound to have. And as for documents, he has used only such as chance or mischance put in his way. Summoned to give evidence regarding what was a sort of crime, he has exercised the restraint that behooves a conscientious witness. All the same, following the dictates of his heart, he has deliberately taken the victim's side and tried to share with his fellow citizens the only certitudes they had in common: love, exile, and suffering. Thus he can truly say, there wasn't one of their anxieties in which he didn't share, no predicament of theirs that wasn't his. To be an honest witness, it was for him to confine himself mainly to what people did or said, and what could be gleaned from documents. Regarding his personal troubles and his long suspense, his duty was to hold his peace. When now and then he refers to such matters, it's only for the light they may throw on his fellow citizens, and in order to give a picture, as well defined as possible, of what most of the time they felt confusedly. Actually, this self-imposed reticence cost him little effort. Whenever tempted to add his personal note to the myriad voices of the plague-stricken, he was deterred by the thought that not one of his sufferings but was common to all the others, and that in a world where sorrow is so often lonely, this was an advantage. Thus, decidedly, it was up to him to speak for all. But there was at least one of our townsfolk for whom Dr. Rieu couldn't speak. The man of whom Tarrou said one day to Rieu, "His only real crime is that of having in his heart approved of something that killed off men, women, and children. I can understand the rest, but for that, I am obliged to pardon him." It's fitting that this chronicle should end with some reference to that man, who had an ignorant, that is to say, lonely heart. On turning out of the main thoroughfares, where the rejoicings were in full swing, and entering the street where Grawn and Kotar lived. Dr. Ryu was held up by a police cordon. Nothing could have surprised him more. This quiet part of the town seemed all the quieter for the sounds of festivity in the distance, and the doctor pictured it as deserted as it was tranquil.
"Sorry, doctor," a policeman said, "but I can't let you through. There's a crazy fellow with a gun shooting at everybody. But you'd better stay. We may need you."
Just then Ryu saw Grawn coming toward him. Grawn, too, had no idea what was happening, and the police had stopped him, too. He had been told that the shots came from the house where he lived. They could see some way down the street, the front of the house, bathed in cool evening light. Farther down the street was another line of policemen like the one that had prevented Ryu and Grawn from advancing. And behind the line, some of the local residents could be seen crossing and recrossing the street hastily. The street immediately in front of the house was quite empty, and in the middle of the hollow square lay a hat and a piece of dirty cloth. Looking more carefully, they saw more policemen, revolvers in hand, sheltering in doorways facing the house. All the shutters in Grawn's house were closed, except one on the third floor that seemed to be hanging loose on one hinge only. Not a sound could be heard in the street, but for occasional snatches of music coming from the center of the town. Suddenly, two revolver shots rang out. They came from one of the buildings opposite, and some splinters flew off the dismantled shutter. Then silence came again. Seen from a distance, after the tumult of the day, the whole business seemed to Ryu fantastically unreal, like something in a dream. "That's Kotar's window," Grawn suddenly exclaimed. "I can't make it out. I thought he disappeared." "Why are they shooting?" Ryu asked the policeman.
"Oh, just to keep him busy. We're waiting for a car to come with the stuff that's needed. He fires at anyone who tries to get in by the front door. He got one of our men just now."
"But why did he fire?"
"Ask me another. Some folks were having fun in the street, and he let off at them. They couldn't make it out at first. When he fired again, they started yelling. One man was wounded, and the rest took to their heels. Some fellow out of his head, I should say."
The minutes seemed interminable in the silence that had returned. Then they noticed a dog. The first dog Ryu had seen for many months, emerging on the other side of the street, a draggled-looking spaniel that its owners had, presumably, kept in hiding. It ambled along the wall, stopped in the doorway, sat down, and began to dig at its fleas. Some of the policemen whistled for it to come away. It raised its head, then walked out into the road and was sniffing at the hat when a revolver barked from the third-floor window. The dog did a somersault like a tossed pancake, lashed the air with its legs, and floundered onto its side, its body writhing in long convulsions. As if by way of reprisal, five or six shots from the opposite house knocked more splinters off the shutter. Then silence fell again. The sun had moved a little, and the shadow line was nearing Kotar's window. There was a low squeal of brakes in the street behind the doctor.
"Here they are," the policeman said.
A number of police officers jumped out of the car and unloaded coils of rope, a ladder, and two big oblong packages wrapped in oilcloth. Then they turned into a street behind the row of houses facing Grawn's. A minute or so later, there were signs of movement, though little could be seen, in the doorways of the houses. Then came a short spell of waiting. The dog had ceased moving. It now was lying in a small, dark, glistening pool. Suddenly, from the window of one of the houses that the police officers had entered from behind, there came a burst of machine gun fire. They were still aiming at the shutter, which literally shredded itself away, disclosing a dark gap into which neither Gron nor Ryu could see from where they stood. When the first machine gun stopped firing, another opened up from a different angle, in a house a little farther up the street. The shots were evidently directed into the window space, and a fragment of the brickwork clattered down upon the pavement. At the same moment, three police officers charged across the road and disappeared into the doorway. The machine gun ceased fire. Then came another wait. Two muffled detonations sounded inside the house, followed by a confused hubbub growing steadily louder until they saw a small man in his shirt sleeves, screaming at the top of his voice, being carried more than dragged out by the doorway. As if at an expected signal, all the shutters in the street flew open, and excited faces lined the windows, while people screamed out of the houses and jostled the lines of police. Ryu had a brief glimpse of the small man, on his feet now, in the middle of the road, his arms pinioned behind him by two police officers. He was still screaming. A policeman went up and dealt him two hard blows with his fists, quite calmly, with a sort of conscientious thoroughness. "It's Kotar!" Gron's voice was shrill with excitement. "He's gone mad!" Kotar had fallen backwards, and the policeman launched a vigorous kick into the crumpled mass sprawling on the ground. Then a small, surging group began to move toward the doctor and his old friend. "Stand clear," the policeman bawled. Ryu looked away when the group, Kotar and his captors, passed him. The dusk was thickening into night when Gron and the doctor made a move at last. The Kotar incident seemed to have shaken the neighborhood out of its normal lethargy, and even these remote streets were becoming crowded with noisy merrymakers. On his doorstep, Gron bade the doctor goodnight. He was going to put in an evening's work, he said. Just as he was starting up the stairs, he added that he'd written to Jean and was feeling much happier. Also, he'd made a fresh start with this phrase. "I've cut out all the adjectives." And with a twinkle in his eye, he took his hat off, bringing it low in a courtly sweep. But Ryu was thinking of Kotar, and the dull thud of fists belaboring the wretched man's face haunted him as he went to visit his old asthma patient. Perhaps it was more painful to think of a guilty man than of a dead man. It was quite dark by the time he reached his patient's house. In the bedroom, the distant clamor of a populace rejoicing in its new-won freedom could be faintly heard, and the old fellow was, as usual, transposing peas from one pan to another. "They're quite right to amuse themselves," he said. "It takes all sorts to make a world, as they say. And your colleague, doctor? How's he getting on?" "He's dead." Ryu was listening to his patient's rumbling chest.
"Oh, really?"
The old fellow sounded embarrassed. "Of plague," Ryu added. "Yes," the old man said after a moment's silence. "It's always the best to go. That's how life is. But he was a man who knew what he wanted."
"Why do you say that?"
The doctor was putting back his stethoscope.
"Oh, for no particular reason. Only, well, he never talked just for talking's sake. I'd rather cotton to him. But there you are. All those folks are saying, 'It was plague. We've had the plague here.' You'd almost think they expected to be given medals for it. But what does that mean? Plague. Just life. No more than that."
"Do your inhalations regularly."
"Don't worry about me, doctor. There's lots of life in me yet, and I'll see 'em all into their graves.
I know how to live.
A burst of joyful shouts in the distance seemed an echo of his boast. Halfway across the room, the doctor halted. Would you mind if I go up on the terrace?
Of course not. You'd like to have a look at him, that it? But they're just the same as ever, really.
When Ryu was leaving the room, a new thought crossed his mind.
I say, doctor, is it a fact they're going to put up a memorial to the people who died of plague?
So the papers say.
A monument, or just a tablet? I could have sworn it. And there'll be speeches.
He chuckled throatily.
I can almost hear them saying, our dear departed. And then they'll go off and have a good snack.
Ryu was already halfway up the stairs. Cold, fathomless depths of sky glimmered overhead. And near the hilltops, stars shone hard as flint. It was much like the night when he and Teru had come to the terrace to forget the plague. Only tonight the sea was breaking on the cliffs more loudly, and the air was calm and limpid, free of the tang of brine the autumn wind had brought. The noises of the town were still beating like waves at the foot of the long line of terraces. But tonight, they told not of revolt, but of deliverance. In the distance, a reddish glow hung above the big central streets and squares. In this night of newborn freedom, desires knew no limits, and it was their clamor that reached Ryu's ears. From the dark harbor soared the first rocket of the firework display organized by the municipality, and the town acclaimed it with a long-drawn sigh of delight. Kotar, Teru, the men and the woman Ryu had loved and lost, all alike, dead or guilty, were forgotten. Yes, the old fellow had been right. These people were just the same as ever. But this was at once their strength and their innocence, and it was on this level, beyond all grief, that Ryu could feel himself at one with them. And it was in the midst of shouts rolling against the terrace wall in massive waves that waxed in volume and duration, while cataracts of colored fire fell thicker through the darkness, that Dr. Ryu resolved to compile this chronicle, so that he should not be one of those who hold their peace, but should bear witness in favor of those plague-stricken people, so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done them might endure. And to state quite simply, what we learn in time of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in men than to despise. Nonetheless, he knew that the tale he had to tell couldn't be one of a final victory. It could only be the record of what had to be done, and what assuredly would have to be done again in the never-ending fight against terror and its relentless onslaughts, despite their personal afflictions, by all who, while unable to be saints but refusing to bow down to pestilences, strive their utmost to be healers. And indeed, as he listened to the cries of joy rising from the town, Ryu remembered that such joy is always imperiled. He knew what those jubilant crowds did not know, but could have learned from books. That the plague bacillus never dies or disappears for good. That it can lie dormant for years and years in furniture and linen chests. That it bides its time in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, and bookshelves. And that perhaps the day would come when, for the bane and the enlightening of men, it would rouse up its rats again and send them forth to die in a happy city.
The End. You've been listening to The Plague by Albert Camus, translated from the French by Stuart Gilbert and narrated by James Jenner.
This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.